That's not what I thought.
You guys keep doing what you're doing, right? You're fine.
I think the first thing I have to do is determine if A, you and has an inversion matrix. So I think I have to do that. So that would be...
Why are you guys trying to find inverse matrices and stuff like that?
They're going to announce on Tuesday of using eigenvalues and eigenvectors, and I'm wondering if that's the inverse
matrix. Nobody's asking you to solve the equation.
Well, that's how we find the equilibrium.
No.
You just set the derivative equal to zero.
Okay, yeah, so you would
recall. So, yeah, see where it's definitely the equilibrium solution. I'm wondering why. Any substitution here, regardless of what you substitute,
right.
X is going to have to be equal to Y. And considering you've got a constant times,
since we don't have
a variable is equal to zero, and that variable has to be equal to zero.
Yeah.
Any other value, then it would be four times some non zero value.
Yeah, so.
It can be X and Y.
I mean, okay, so I think you guys have had long enough to do this problem. Okay, so one thing to keep in mind is what I'm about to say wouldn't work if this matrix does not have an inverse. But we haven't talked about any of that. I think we can always assume for most practical problems, this matrix is going to have an inverse. Okay? And so the first part of the quiz just asks you to find the matrix equation. So I would write this, but you also have to show this. Otherwise, I don't know what A is, right? So you have to tell me what A is, you have to tell me what X is. And once you've done that, how do you find the equilibrium? Yeah, you set this thing equal to zero. So, now, most of you have not had linear algebra, but if this matrix A has an inverse, then the only way for this statement to be true is for this matrix to be zero. I'm going to ask you to put the food away.
Oh, okay.
And don't be eating it.
Oh, all right.
Just let you know that food sounds really bug me.
Oh,
okay.
Sorry about that.
And I think there's a thing in the syllabus that talks about it. If I can hear it,
yeah,
or if I can smell it, I'm going to ask you to stop it.
Okay.
So, based on the examples that we did in class the last week or so with the... Or I guess, did we start it on Tuesday? Is that when we started systems? I think we did that. We started on last Thursday. Okay. So, our equilibrium was always at the origin. Why was it at the origin? Yeah, these things, first of all, they're linear. Secondly, the matrix has an inverse. Therefore, the equilibrium has to be at the origin. So, therefore, x, y equals 0, 0. That's it. Now, if you want to get fancy, you can, you know, take the inverse of both sides, or multiply both sides of this by the inverse. You know, you set this equal to 0, multiply, so you get A inverse times A times X is equal to A inverse times the 0 matrix, but that's going to equal 0, and A inverse times A is the identity, and the identity times X is X, so therefore X is equal to 0. So that's maybe carrying it to a little bit of an extreme, but that's the thought process. Okay? So everybody hand your quiz forward. Make sure your name is on the quiz. Here's the sign-in sheet. Send that around. Also, if you haven't turned in your homework, be sure that you do that before you leave tonight. So there was a question in the during office hours about the problems 28 and 29. So I'm going to do problem 28. I'll have to admit that the sign conventions I always have to puzzle over a little bit. So and they sort of explained that in the previous problem. This is the one with the circuits. Did you guys all get that? Some of you maybe.
Which chapter is this from?
This is section 3.2. So the homework is due today. We haven't done a lot of circuit applications. I don't think we've done any. But they're... and part of the reason is because... when you get into your double E classes, if you are double E's, you're probably not going to do it this way anyway. You're probably going to use complex frequencies and things of that sort. So, but if you're taking physics, you may have seen it, depending on your teacher. A lot of teachers don't even teach that anymore, although I think that's unfortunate. But... So let me just draw the circuit here. So this is 2 ohms. This is 0.5 farads. By the way, very unrealistic value. this is 1 ohm, and this is an inductor with 1 henry of inductance. And it's asking you to show that the following system of equations is obtained. So di, dt is equal to negative I minus V, and I'll say what these symbols are in a minute, and then the other equation is dV dt is equal to 2I minus V. And where, now I is the this current, so they define it as the current through the inductor, but it's also the same current going through this resistor. And then the V is the voltage across the capacitor. And so I'm going to call this V, and we can put a plus here and a minus here. They have arrows that indicate the sign convention. I'm sort of ignoring those because I'm going to impose my own sign convention on this, but you should get the right answer. And so the any questions so far about this? I mean, if you've never seen these symbols before, this is you're going to see this in a physics class. I think there was something. Okay. Did anybody not sign this? 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 15. I have 3 blanks here, and there's 19. Let's see.
So there's an extra signature?
There's an extra signature. Somebody signed and left, perhaps. Did that happen? Did you see that happen?
I've seen it before, yeah.
I've seen it before, but... Ted? Riley? Matthew Drobnich? Not here? Okay, I have a signature for Matthew. That's pretty bizarre.
Yeah.
Well, it's, I mean, there's no mystery about it. There's a signature for Matthew. Okay, so we figured out the problem, I think. Okay, so what I was saying is that in a physics class, especially electricity and magnetism, you'd probably spend some time talking about these elements. This is a resistor, and these are, by the way, all passive components. So the you get a voltage drop across the resistor, which is the current times the resistance. The voltage, so the LVI dt is equal to the V. So the voltage drop across the inductor is the
it's 2 pi L.
I'm sorry, what?
2 pi times the frequency times...
Yeah, I'm not doing that way. We're not talking about the complex representation. We're doing it in terms of differential equations.
Okay.
If that's okay. I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay, but so the LDI DT would be the V sub L. Right. Right. So the inductance times the change in current is equal to the voltage across the current or across the inductor. CdVdt is the I here, so I is equal to CdVdt. And I'm not going to, I'm not turning this into a physics class, but, you know, they talk about this stuff in the previous problem. Was that problem assigned?
Yeah.
Okay, so you probably have a chance to look at that. And then, of course, V resistor is equal to I times the resistance R. So these are the facts that you need in order to do this. You also need something called Kirchhoff's voltage law and Kirchhoff's current law. The voltage law, I'm going to use the voltage loop around this loop here, and then I'm going to have the three currents that come into this node here. And so this current plus this current has to equal the outgoing current. And if we do that right, then we'll end up with the equations correctly. So let's do the current equation first. If we call this the voltage across the capacitor, then, and if, with this sign convention, then this current is going to be V sub C divided by this 2, the resistance. So it's the V divided by R is equal to the I. And so V C divided by 2. Now this we're calling I because that's what they're telling us to call it. It's the I through the inductor, but that's the same as this I through this branch of the circuit. And then this I is C dVdt, but C is 0.5, so this current is 0.5 times dVdt. And so I think the current equation is a little easier to do, so we do that first. And so let's add those. So V sub C divided by 2 plus this current, which is 0.5 times dVdt, and this is the same V, right? It's the V sub C. And that's equal to this current, which we call I. Now, there's nothing special about these names. I mean, the textbook is telling us to call this I. I could call it I1, I could call it, you know, IR, IL, whatever. Now what do we do? What would you think is the next step? Multiply by 2. So you get, and I'm going to drop this the subscript C because the voltage across the capacitor they're calling V. So multiply through by 2, you get V plus 2 times 0.5 is 1. So you get dV dt. And that's equal to 2i, because we're multiplying both sides by 2. And now, they're asking us to show that it actually reduces to this. Well, if I subtract v from both sides, we get dv dt is equal to 2i minus v. So we accomplished this equation by using Kirchhoff's current law at this node here. Any questions about that?
Between that node and, I guess, the very bottom, across the capacitor, I guess.
Yes.
Is there supposed to be a positive end here?
Well, I drew a plus sign here and a minus sign there, so that's my voltage sign convention that I'm using.
Oh, okay.
Yes?
Where'd you get the 0.5 dVdt from?
Because, so I is equal to the capacitance times dVdt, and C is 0.5. Any other questions? Okay, now let's do, I'm going to do a loop, a Kirchhoff voltage loop around that particular loop of the circuit. Now there's a whole lot of theory about how many equations you need and, you know, which ones do you need and so on. So we're not getting into any of that. That would be like a junior level systems course in electrical engineering. And so unless you're an electrical engineer, you don't need to know that stuff. But and I'm not even trying to prove that these equations are sufficient to describe the network. But the now, one way to do this is to have voltage rises, voltage rise, voltage rise, and it equals what?
Zero.
So if we do that, so the this voltage is just V sub C. This voltage is going to be IR, so plus IR. And then, what is the R in this case?
One.
So I just put it I times one so you don't miss that. And then plus, now
I think if you labeled the resistors, since there's two resistors, you know, like,
well, I know this is we're already done with the resistor. I'm thinking about this conductor
now,
which is I want the I want the voltage drop across that inductor. So that's LDIDT.
Yeah.
So I'm okay. So L is 1. So 1 times DIDT. Yeah, I don't know why I started sweating bullets there for a moment. This should disturb you a little bit. The fact that there's a current here and a voltage here. But this isn't a current. This is a current times a resistance, which is a voltage. And this isn't a current, this is a voltage. So the voltage, voltage, voltage. And so the units all work out. And, you know, as a physicist, you're always worried about units. You want to make sure that the units are correct. But we're just not showing the fact that we're multiplying by a resistor here. So that's why I left this one here, just to remind you that that's why the units work out. Now this is the final result. We're not quite there yet. And this V sub C, I can drop the subscript, so we get V plus I plus, and this was all equal to zero, right? Mm-hmm. Plus DIDT equals zero. And so now I'm going to subtract the V and the I from both sides, so we get DIDT is equal to negative I minus V, and that's the other equation, that's this one up here. Now you guys had questions, was it about the sign convention, or?
I just got confused by it. Like in 27 it talks about how it's V2, V3, I1, I2, and so just the way it was written.
The labeling. It is confusing. You've got to think a little bit about what the V refers to, because there's a voltage across all of these elements, right? And a current through all of the elements. So they're cherry picking exactly which ones they want. Now what makes this a system? So you've got think of this as X1 and this is X2, right? And then this is your X1 and your X2, and this is your X1 and your X2. So this is a system that has two dependent variables and then one independent variable, which is the time. So if you wanted to, you could make a matrix equation out of this. A little different notation than what you're used to with the X's and X1, X2, or the X and the Y, or whatever, but it's the same idea. Now, I'm not going to do the other one because I think this is enough of an explanation. If you're interested, go ahead and just spend some time. And really, the best way to learn this stuff, I mean, like I say, I don't work with it enough to be comfortable with the sign conventions. And so I always have to think about, I'm going in this direction, am I adding or am I subtracting? If you're an electrical engineer, you get really good at that pretty quickly. So, any other questions about this problem? Was this helpful? Okay. So, let's just go ahead and continue with where we were last time. And, let's see, before I forget. So we started on complex eigenvalues, and about all I said was we have this thing called the Euler identity, which is going to turn out to be useful. So I didn't get any further than that after talking about the real distinct eigenvalues. So let's... let's do a specific example. So we were actually solving y double prime plus y is equal to zero. And we looked at two different ways to approach it. One was to assume something of the form y is equal to some constant times e to the lambda t. And what you end up with is your lambda is plus or minus I, which is no longer current now. It's I in this context is the imaginary unit, square root of negative 1. So that was one way we solved it. The other way we solved it was we assumed that y was equal to a times cosine t plus b times sine t or some variation on that. And I plugged it in, showed that that actually does satisfy the differential equation for all a and b. And then I said, so we're going to treat this using a system approach. Remember how we do, this is a second order linear differential equation. So we're going to say, okay, let's let x1 equal y. And x2 is equal to y prime. And now we're going to differentiate both sides of this first equation, so we get x1 prime is equal to y. Did I do that right? No, this is supposed to be a prime, this is supposed to be a double prime. So x1 prime is equal to y double prime. Am I doing that right? X1 is equal to y. No, I had it right the first time. I'm sorry. Let's do that over. So x1 is equal to y, and x2 is equal to y prime. Okay, so x2 is equal to y prime. Now, then we differentiate both sides of this equation. So we get x1 prime is equal to y prime, and we differentiate both sides here. We get x2 prime is equal to y double prime, but y double prime is equal to negative y, and negative y is minus x1, so this is negative x1, and y prime is x2. Now, it seems a little convoluted to get there, but when you do, you will have a system. Your x1 prime and your x2 prime is equal to something involving x1 and x2. So we can, let me rewrite that over here. So we get x1, x2 prime is equal to, now, so x1 prime is the same as x2. So I put a 0, 1 here. So this is 0x1 plus 1x2. So that's this equation. And then negative 1 times x1, so this is negative 1, And then there is no x2 in this particular case, so we have a 0 there. And then what do we have to multiply by? X1, x2. And so x prime is equal to a times x is our differential equation. It's a system of equations in this case. So now we want to, remember how we solved this system last time? We assume that the determinant of what? A minus lambda I has to equal zero. So what is A times, or A minus lambda I? Well, this is A. If we subtract, now we don't know what lambda is yet, so how do we find lambda?
Multiply it out. Substitute A for the matrix A, and then...
Well, this is how we're going to find it, right? So A minus lambda I is 0 minus lambda. So I just write minus lambda here. I'll put a 1 here. I'll put a negative 1 here. And then what goes here? Negative lambda. Okay. And we want the determinant of that. So the determinant of this is equal to 0. Well, so the way you usually write a determinant is by using vertical bars. If I use the brackets, that indicates that it's a matrix. But if I use vertical bars, then we're talking about a determinant. So I put negative lambda, 1, negative 1, negative lambda. And now we're going to, what is that determinant? Well, it's equal to negative lambda times negative lambda, which is lambda squared, minus a negative 1, which is the same as plus 1. And we want that determinant to be 0. So, therefore, lambda squared is equal to 1. So lambda is equal to plus or minus I.
How do you get lambda squared plus 1 on the right side?
Determinant. Do you all know how to do a 2 by 2 determinant? If you have... So, in general... Let me just do this in general. So A11, A12, A21, A22. The determinant of that matrix, and again, the vertical bars tell you you're taking a determinant, this is equal to the product of these two things minus the product of these two. So you get A11, A22, minus A12, A21. That's the determinant. Why is that true? This is not a linear algebra class. We're not going to talk about the definition of the determinant. It's easy enough to illustrate why this is important in a 2x2, but there's a more complicated algorithm for finding the determinant. When we get to 3x3s, we'll talk about that. But in the meantime, let's just focus on 2x2s. Any questions on this? You all know how to do a determinant? And so you all see where this came from. Yes? Does that make sense? Okay. I mean, it's negative lambda times negative lambda minus 1 times negative 1. So negative lambda times negative lambda is positive lambda squared. And then minus, so this is 1 times negative 1, which is negative 1. Minus negative 1 is plus 1. And we're saying the determinant has to be 0, so therefore lambda is plus or minus I. Now remember, we had a kind of a bookkeeping method we were going to use. We say lambda equals I. Now, with complex eigenvalues, and by the way, as soon as you see that you get something involving an I, now we're into a different realm. Last time we did real eigenvalues. We had like negative 2 and positive 3 or whatever they were. If you have positive eigenvalues, we do it the way we did it last time. And so for each eigenvalue, you find the corresponding V vector, and then you can write the solution based on that. But complex is a little different because you have these are always going to occur in complex conjugate pairs, right? These are plus or minus I. These are complex conjugates of each other. And for real matrices, you're always going to get these things in complex conjugate pairs. So what we're going to do is we're going to just use one of them, pick whichever one you want. Usually the one that has fewer minus signs is the easier one, so that's why I chose the lambda equals I. And then we're going to go through a process, and we'll get the complete solution that way. So now I'm going to plug in to the A minus lambda I. So what do we have here? Well, here's our A minus lambda I matrix. And everywhere you see a lambda, we replace it with I. So we get negative I, 1, negative 1, negative I. And then what do I write over here? Remember the process from last time? 2 days ago? Multiply by B1, B2. And what does that have to equal? 0, 0. Okay? Now, if we've done our work correctly, these should be redundant equations. And did I think that is true? Yes? Okay, good. So, what do we do next? Well, pick one of the equations. So, negative I times V1 plus V2 is equal to 0. And now we have to pick our V1 and V2. In this case, the easy thing to do is to solve for V2. And so V2 is equal to I times V1. And what we're looking for is our V vector. And what would be a good choice? For what?
For V1.
V1 is 1. Okay, good. Then what does that make V2?
I.
Now, you have an infinite number of choices, okay? And some people might even do something weird like put, let V1 equal to I, and then I times I is negative 1, so V2 would be negative 1. I mean, you have those choices, right? So you can do that, but usually we want to just keep it as simple as possible when we do this. Okay, so now we know what our V is. And so what do we do? Now, I'm going to erase this part here. Actually, I probably can do some over here. So what's the next step? Well, we can write our solution, X1, if you wish, is equal to, now, I'll put arbitrary constants on this when we get to the end, but what do I write here?
I. 1i
e to the
lambda t.
What's lambda?
I t.
Okay? Now this is complex. This function, whatever it is, it has some real parts and it has some imaginary parts. And we don't want to leave it in this form. That's not going to work for us. Because we're in the real world. And even with physics and engineering, you always want to end up with real solutions. Always.
you might say, well, why do we have complex numbers in the first place? Well, because it gives us an opportunity. I like to think of it this way. You jump into complex hyperspace, you do your stuff, like algebra is always easier in the complex number system, and then you can revert back to the real world. And you might say, well, why? I don't believe you. You know, well, see, so far we've avoided trigonometry. Okay? And remember, one of the ways to solve this problem is using sine and cosine. But now, and by the way, the freebie that we're going to get out of this is the phase portrait. So there is a benefit in going into, jumping into the complex hyperspace. Okay, so what do we do next? Well, this is equal to 1i. Now, can you tell me what n to the i t is?
Cosine t plus I sine t.
Yeah, so it's, and put these in parentheses, so cosine t plus I sine t. I can't resist saying this. One of my teacher friends calls this the Euler sausage. You know, it's just kind of this long thing. You're gonna end up writing this a lot in these kinds of problems. So now this is the matrix times this thing. Well, we can write this now as a matrix. So one time. So think of this as a scalar, if you wish, multiplying a vector, and so you multiply each of the components. So this is going to be cosine t plus I sine t in the first part, the first component of your of this matrix. What do you get when you multiply it times I?
I cosine t minus sine t.
Yeah, so you get I cosine t minus, now why the minus? Because I times I is negative 1. I squared is negative 1. So you get minus sine t. Now we usually rewrite this so that we put the real parts here. Now this it's all, how many columns is in this matrix? One column. How many rows? So two rows, one column. Why is it only one column? Well, because this is something added to something. It's not, these are not separate components. These are added together. So I usually write them with the real terms sort of glommed to the left, and then the imaginary terms are glommed to the right. And so I would write this as cosine t plus I sine t, and then negative sine t plus I cosine t. And I think I can get one, I don't know if you guys can see this, maybe some of the people in the back, if I write it down here, equals so I would write this as cosine t negative sine t, and then plus I times sine t cosine t. Probably not a good idea, but I did that anyway. Okay, so I'll leave our original equation up there. Yes.
This Euler's identity.
Euler's
identity is that a reference? You mentioned advancing on the trigonometric aspect. Is that a reference to a matrix times a vector? The y value is an imaginary component, and the cosine t is the real component.
Well, this is your x one. I mean, without having an arbitrary constant in front of it, but. But we're not done yet finding the particular solutions. So I wouldn't think of this as a matrix times. I mean, This satisfies the differential equation, if that's what you're trying to say.
I'm more thinking it was a trigonometric side, because when I first learned the imaginary values, it was with reference to vector equations and vector algebra, and they were basically taking a real component and combining it with an imaginary component and then graphing it in the form of a vector. And this seems to be very heavily implying a vector, but broken down into the real and imaginary components. I.e. cosine t is the x value, so I sine t is the imaginary.
Well, this is the vector, and this is the vector. And this is,
so this is
I times a vector.
So it, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, I think when we draw, so some people distinguish matrices and vectors, and there's a good reason to. If it's a column matrix, then that's a vector. If it's a row matrix, then that's the transpose of the vector, or the transpose of the matrix.
Okay.
So, yeah, everything you know about vectors and matrices still holds. Yeah.
So if you multiply the V's by the matrix, you get your solution that you solve on the board. But if you multiply it by that second row...
This is V.
No, on the left side. When you multiply V1, -1, V2...
Okay, V1. Yes.
So when you solve for that... You can use that in your solution, right? The second row. But it's not going to give you the same answer.
What do you mean? This is equivalent to this.
When you multiply it, not by the first row, but by the second row, you're going to get a different...
You're talking about -I and -2.
Correct.
Okay, negative V1 minus IV2 equals 0. So let's add V1 to both sides. So we get V1 is equal to negative IV2. And now if I do, here we solve for V2. Here we solve for V1. So if we let V2 be I, what do you get? So V2 is I, which is exactly what we had here. So I times negative I is what?
One.
Positive 1. So that's exactly the same thing. Okay. Remember, there's an infinite number of possible solutions to each of these equations. This equation comes from this matrix product, and this equation comes from this matrix product. If we've done our A minus lambda I and the determinant of that correctly, then they should give us the same results. They may look a little different, but I mean, by the correct choice, you can see that they're exactly the same. But, you know, when I first wrote it down, I don't know if you noticed, but I did a double take. It bothered me a little bit that this was a plus and this was a minus. And some of you may have noticed that. And so how could these be the same equations? Well, they're not the same equations, but I plays games with you. Because, you know, if I choose I for V2, I times I is equal to negative 1. Negative 1 times negative 1 is positive 1. So that's how we get the right result. Okay. Now, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to say x real is equal to cosine t, negative sine t, x imaginary is equal to sine t, cosine t, and I'm going to make the statement that these two solutions are the two solutions that we're looking for. And then I'm going to write the final result. X is equal to C1 X real. Now notice there's no E to the whatever here, because the E to the whatever got replaced with the cosine t plus I sine t. So this is cosine t here, negative sine t plus c2 sine t and cosine t. And this is the solution of the differential equation. So, just recapping, first you find the complex eigenvalue. So you find the eigenvalue, and then you decide, okay, how are we going to do this problem? If they're real and distinct, you do it the way we did it on Tuesday. If it turns out that they are complex eigenvalues, then you do it the way we're doing it here. And then the next step, which we'll hopefully do tonight, is repeated eigenvalues. And so we'll talk about that in a little bit. But so you find the eigenvalue, you figure out what your V is, and so in this case, this is our V, and it will always, because of the complex eigenvalues, you will always have, it won't necessarily be just an I, it could be something more complicated. But you have your V, you have your lambda, and then you Eulerize everybody just walk out. I shouldn't do summaries, right? It's not a good idea. You Eulerize the e to the whatever. Now sometimes, see, this is pure imaginary, so there's going to be times when you have actually a complex a plus bi, so you have a real part here, and that will be some sort of exponential decay, and we'll deal with that. We'll do an example of that. Once you have it Eulerized, then you write it out. You just do the algebra to rewrite it into this form. You put the real part here, the imaginary part here. You want to have an I in front, and then you recognize that the real part is the vector that's on the left, the imaginary is the vector that's on the right, the one that's being multiplied by the I, and then your final solution is the coefficient times the real part plus the coefficient times the imaginary part.
So how do we make that jump from the imaginary part having an imaginary?
Okay, so it isn't magic. We can prove that both of these will satisfy the differential equation. And if we used the other, the complex conjugate of this eigenvalue, we would get the same answer.
Okay.
So
if we had used negative I.
If you had used negative I, you would end up in the same place.
Okay.
Now, you may end up with a minus sign here and a plus sign here or something like that, but remember that can get absorbed into, you know, any multiplicative constant that applies to both of these elements in the vector, these components, can be absorbed into the arbitrary constant. So those superficial differences shouldn't really bother you too much. Yes?
If that's the case, is it ever a bad idea for us to simplify something down to an easier number to work with? I mean, if it's a massive number, we factor it down to something smaller?
Yeah, well, that was the whole point in, you know, you want to, when you solve an equation like this, like, you don't want fractions if you can avoid them, right? So you maybe, like what I did, we had something in the denominator, so I chose to multiply by something that would clear the denominator. If you looked at it and it was 1,000 and, you know, 1,200 or something like that, yeah, go ahead and divide both sides. I mean, those are perfectly legitimate simplifications. Won't change the answer for exactly this reason. Any multiplicative constant will get absorbed into the arbitrary constant. Yes?
So the idea is to split them up into two, and then have one as C1 and C2.
So think of this as the real part of the solution, this is the imaginary part of the solution, and your final function, the solution, the general solution, is some arbitrary constant times this vector plus an arbitrary constant times this vector. You leave the I out.
So it's always going to be in the form of C1 plus C2.
Or whatever you want to call them, but yeah. You're going to have, for a second order differential equation or a 2x2, two first order equations, you always have two arbitrary constants. And they have to, we're going to talk about this later, I've hesitated to use the term linearly independent. And there's this thing called a Wronskian that you may have run into if you're reading the textbook. The Wronskian is a function that helps you determine whether your functions are linearly independent or not. And we could apply that here and show that, in fact, they are linearly independent. If they're not linearly independent, you don't really have two solutions. You only have one solution. You need two independent solutions. Okay. Yes?
Does this work, or is the I in this case getting absorbed into the arbitrary constant?
No. Because the arbitrary constants are going to have to be real.
Okay.
There's, I mean, you can play games with your V, right? If I want V1 to be I, then I'll get a real number for V2 or something, you know. These things can be complex, and in general, they are complex. But but that's before we Eulerized, right? So we took this and we turned it into something that's real plus an imaginary part. And once you've Eulerized it, then you can separate them. Here, you can't separate this into a real part and an imaginary part until you go through this. This is why the Euler identity is so important. It gives us a way to separate the complex function here into a real part and an imaginary part.
And if we had proceeded with also using lambda equals negative I, and we had done what we did with the previous thing, that would have ended up with these...
Well, your equation here would have been a little different, but it would give you the same reason. I mean, to within a multiplicative constant. And then when you Eulerize it, you would end up with the same thing to within a multiplicative constant. Okay? These are all good questions. It's important that you understand this. Okay, so let me do one more example like this. Now, I'm not showing you the proofs that both of these will satisfy the differential equation, and I can do it in a general way. I think the textbook may have it, or if you're interested, come see me during office hours, and I can walk through it pretty quickly with you. It's not hard. So sometimes the theory is interesting, but sometimes if you just take my word for it, that's not always a good idea. But okay, I want to do something that's a little bit more complicated. Yeah, let's do this one. Okay, so erasing. So let's suppose that we've got x prime is equal to 1, negative 1, 5, negative 3 times x. And, you know, in general, you're not going to know ahead of time whether the eigenvalues are real and distinct or complex or repeated. So you just have to go through the same process. You want the determinant of A minus lambda I equals 0. And so I'm just going to go ahead and write the determinant here. So 1 minus lambda, negative 1. You don't forget to subtract the lambda I. You know, this isn't the matrix you want to work with. To do this, you want to subtract lambda I, so you're going to have lambda being subtracted from all the diagonal elements. And then here you've got a 5, and here you've got your negative 3 minus lambda. And this has to equal 0. So now we multiply this out, so 1 minus lambda times negative 3 minus lambda plus, so minus a negative 5 is plus 5, equals 0. Now, as I said last time, oftentimes this is the hardest part of the problem because you've got to solve this equation for lambda. So multiply it out so you get negative 3 plus 3 lambda minus lambda is plus 2 lambda, and then plus lambda squared and plus 5 is equal 0. So lambda squared plus 2 lambda plus 2 is equal to 0. And now that's not going to factor in integers, so let's use the quadratic formula. So lambda is equal to negative b plus or minus the square root of b squared minus 4 times a times c all over 2a. So negative 2 plus or minus, now that's going to be 4 minus 8, which is negative 4. So the square root of negative 4 is 2i over 2, so we can simplify that to negative 1 plus or minus I. Now I wanted to do this one because now it's not just pure imaginary, there's actually a real part to the eigenvalue. So an imaginary eigenvalue is going to cause and I didn't draw the base for it, but we'll do that this time. But the imaginary I is going to cause your solution to rotate in phase space. So it's kind of like a situation where you have predator-prey, and if you gobble up too many deer, then you know your tigers might be on the decline for a while, and then the deer population come back, and then now there's a whole lot of deers and not as many tigers, but then the tigers start eating the deer again. So it can oscillate, right? So that's how you get these systems that oscillate. Well, what does the real part do? Well, this real part actually is negative. So remember what happens when the lambda is negative. It decreases, it approaches the equilibrium. I think I need to make a general announcement. If you're going to leave early, you need to get at least let me know that you're going to do that. I think that's not an unreasonable thing, unless you're just like really sick or something. But and by the way, you guys are wonderful. Thank you so much for still being here. Okay, but so you've got this imaginary part, which is the oscillation. And what does an oscillation look like in phase space? Well, it's some sort of cycle, some sort of loop. Okay, it doesn't have to be circular. It could be elliptical. But, and then your eigenvalue, the real part of the eigenvalue is going to determine whether, in this case, it's going to spiral toward the equilibrium point. Okay, so now we have this. Let's make our a minus lambda I. So you have, so 1 minus negative, and let's choose lambda equals negative 1 plus I. Okay, so that's, we have two choices, but they're complex conjugates of each other, so we'll choose one of them. And so we get 1 minus the lambda that we've chosen, which is negative 1 plus I, and we'll simplify this in a moment, and then you've got negative 1 here, and then you've got a 5 here, and then you're negative 3 minus negative 1 plus I. Now I would go ahead and simplify this before doing anything with it. So you get, so 1 minus the negative 1 is 2. So this is going to be 2 minus I. This is negative 1. This is 5. And this is negative 3 plus 1, which is negative 2, minus I. Now we just have to believe, I mean, unless we see evidence to the contrary, but we have to believe that these are dependent equations. And so I'm going to use this to figure out what our V1 and V2 are, and that should equal 0, 0. And it shouldn't matter which of these equations we use, so maybe take the one with the smaller numbers, I don't know. So I'll use the top equation. So you get 2 minus I, now be careful, that has to be in parentheses, times V1, minus V2 is equal to 0. So I'm going to solve for V2. So we solve, we get V2 is equal to 2 minus I times V1. What choice should we make to make this as simple as possible?
V2 equal to I.
V2 is equal to I?
Yeah.
Well, if you say V2 is equal to I, then you're going to have to solve the equation for V1. You're going to be dividing by something, and you want this, you know, if you have a complex number in the denominator, then you have to multiply top and bottom by the complex conjugate and go through all that.
I was trying to say that one, V1 equal to I, but...
Why not just V1 equal 1?
Yeah.
I mean, if you multiply it, if you make this an I, then you're going to get rid of this, but you're going to end up with an I here.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really buy you anything. So V is going to equal... So V1 is 1, then what's V2? 2 minus I. Okay? So now our solution, and I think it, you know, you might not want to use X. I've seen people use other symbols. Maybe let's use W. W of T or whatever, you know, is equal to, now this would be a matrix solution. So this is equal to what? Well, it's your V, which is 1 minus 2, 1, and then 2 minus I. E to the lambda t, well, what is lambda?
Negative 1 plus I.
It's negative 1 plus I. And this is all times t. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to break this apart. This would be negative 1 times t or negative t, and then plus it. So this, in fact, let me just do that here. So you get e to the negative t times e to the it. You all agree with that? Now I'm going to pull this e to the negative t to the front here. So this is equal to e to the negative t. 1, 2 minus I, and then e to the it. What are we going to do to the e to the it?
Eulerize it.
So, this becomes e to the negative t, 1, 2 minus I, and then cosine t plus I sine t. Now, this doesn't always have to be just plain old I. It could be 2I. It could be, you know, something 1/2 I or whatever. But you do want to pull this real part out. You don't want to try to Eulerize that, because that will just get confusing and it's wrong. The real part, so you're going to have an E to the real part of the lambda here, and then you've got your imaginary part of the lambda that you're Eulerizing. And now if you write this, in fact, if you wanted to, you could probably keep it inside the matrix, but I'm just going to leave it outside here. So E to the negative T, and now we've got a 1 here, and this might not be a 1 either. It could be whatever it is, but some number. But times this, so you get cosine T plus I sine T. And then you've got, I need a little bit more room, I think, to do this on the bottom. So you're going to have 2 cosine T plus 2 I sine T minus I cosine T, and then I times I is negative 1. Negative 1 times negative 1 is positive 1, so plus sine T. This is equal to E to the negative T times, now again, let's put the real stuff to the left. It's still a one column matrix, so this is a vector, but, and by the way, I say that, it doesn't matter what we call it, it's a matrix of some form. So you put a cosine here, cosine T, and then plus I sine T. Now maybe we can combine some of this, I don't know. So let's do the real part. So 2 cosine T plus sine T. So 2 cosine T plus sine T. And then plus, and then there's going to be an I times 2 sine T minus cosine T.
Yes.
Any questions so far? Now we recognize this part is the real part, and this part here is the imaginary part. Notice there's an I in front. And don't forget the E to the negative T. So I'm going to go ahead and write the solution up right here. So our final X is equal to C1 E to the negative T cosine T 2 cosine T plus sine T plus E2 E to the, I'm kind of running into myself over here, but E to the negative T, and then what? Sine T and 2 sine T minus cosine T. That makes sense?
So the E negative T stays in both of them?
Yes. Because it's telling you that you're going to have some sort of exponential decay.
You could factor that, couldn't you?
You could. But then what would you do about the arbitrary constant?
You would leave them inside.
You could leave them inside. Yeah, that makes sense too. One reason you want to leave them separate like this is so that it's easy to identify what we call the fundamental solutions. So this is one of the fundamental solutions without the C1, and this is one of the fundamental solutions without the C2. And those fundamental solutions are what you plug into the Wronskian to determine whether they're linearly independent. Which we'll, again, we'll talk about that later. Okay, questions about this? Now I want to draw the face portrait. Actually, do I want to do that here? Yeah. Spiral out. It's not going to be circular. It's going to be some sort of spiral. Now, you have two choices for spiraling in. You can either, and let me do both of them, because I want to illustrate this. So if we do, say, this one and this one. So if we go like this, what's the other way? The other way would be to go like this. Okay. And we know we're going inward, so it would be either this way or it'd be this way. Okay. So how do we tell which is correct? Well, there's actually a very easy way to tell. So pick a point out here, and you can call it anything you want. 1, 0. Right, because depending on the initial condition, you know, there's really an infinite number of these spirals. And this just happens to be one trajectory through your phase space. So I can arbitrarily pick any point in the plane. And so if this is the vector 1, 0, or 1, 0, in this case, if it's a column matrix, how do you get the direction that you're supposed to be going at that moment? Yeah, you take your, and I erased it, of course, but the, so when you take your matrix 1, -1, 5, -3, and you multiply that by 1, 0. And I say, why do we even need to go through all of this nonsense? If we can figure out the trajectory at every point, well, the problem is you might know where it's going here, but then it's just like the Euler method that we did in chapter 8, section 1. You don't know really where to go next without doing some arithmetic. And whereas this sort of takes care of all of that for you. But so let's multiply this out. What do you get? Well, so you get 1, 5. So it's going to look like so up and to the right. So over 1, up 5. So something like this. Now, does that work? No, it does not. So we have to rule this guy out. Whereas, you know, if this is also 1, 0, which way is it going? Well, it's kind of going that way. Does that work? Yes, it does. The slope of my spiral is not quite right, but that it at least now we know that it spirals like this. And so this is the correct phase portrait. Certainly not accurate from the, you know, if we want to know exactly what's going on at each point, this is not going to be correct, but it's close enough for what we need. Yes?
If we were drawing one, like on a test, would you want us to pick points like 1, 0, 0, 1?
Sure. I mean, what, or if I tell you a point to use, or I might say, you know, draw the face portrait, and I, you know, honestly, I would just celebrate if you got this and not this. And I might say, justify your answer. And if I say justify your answer, what does that mean? Well, I want you to show that when you take a point on that trajectory that it's going in the right direction. So I'd want to see this kind of work done. Yes?
In the first place, how do you know it spirals like that? Like just looking at the function, I can't do that.
Okay, so by the way, if you graph these things, we're going to, at some point, I'll fire up Mathematica or something, and we'll take a look at the face portrait, and that's easy to do. Okay, but you know you're going to have some sort of circular motion in the face plane. Why? Because you have complex eigenvalues, and so you've got an imaginary part, and that imaginary part is either going to go this direction or it's going to go in this direction. Now, why is it spiraling in?
Because it goes to zero.
And how do we know that?
Because
of the real part of the lambda is negative. If it was positive, what would it be doing?
Spiraling
outward.
Since there's that negative one, that determines it.
That makes it spiral in. By the way, real world solutions never spiral out. Do you know why? Because the real world doesn't go to infinity. I mean, if something is falling or if it's rubbing against something, you know, eventually you're going to dissipate the energy and this thing is going to come to equilibrium. It's not going to go off to infinity. So, now that doesn't mean that our equations can't spiral out. But if you're modeling something in the real world, you be a little suspicious if you get this behavior of the solution that goes to infinity, because it's not really realistic.
Could we have something that spirals out to an equilibrium?
It could. Yeah. And there are these... Okay, so, yeah, if you really get into this, they're huge... I mean, it's a huge literature on nonlinear dynamical systems. But you could have... your equilibrium could be a circle. And you could start here... And it'd get closer and closer and closer and closer. And, you know, you're asymptotically approaching this circular equilibrium. In fact, it could, you know, you could have a circular equilibrium and it could oscillate like this. Right? So, you're bounded. The system is bounded to certain limits. Nothing that we're... So, you're not going to see that with a linear system. But with the right kind of nonlinear dynamics, you can get that kind of behavior. Yeah, books on chaos theory or nonlinear dynamical systems... this is called an attractor. This thing here. So you have an attractor, and the attractor could be a point too. So you can have some point in space, but it could go around like this. It's trying to get close to that, but there are reasons why it can't get there, and so that would be known as an attractor. So I've just exhausted my entire knowledge of the subject here. So. I actually have a book at home that's about this thick, and it's Oscillating Systems or something is the name of the book. And it's full of this kind of crap. I mean, it's really interesting stuff. You shouldn't. If you're interested, people spend their whole lives studying this.
Is it an orbit?
Yeah, so that you could call it an orbit.
Okay.
Now, I want to do one more thing. So this is, for now, we're concluding our discussion of the complex eigenvalues. Let's talk about repeated eigenvalues. And we're just going to get into this a little bit. today. So, suppose that you have an A, so your X is equal to some matrix, I'm sorry, X prime is equal to some matrix times X, and so this is your A matrix, and suppose we had something like negative 1, 0, 0, negative 1. Now we can see instantly that the eigenvalues for this matrix are negative 1. But let's just verify that. So A minus lambda I is equal to, so negative 1 minus lambda, 0, 0, negative 1 minus lambda. And when we take the determinant of that, then we should get negative 1 minus lambda squared is equal to 0. And so if we take the square root of both sides, we get negative 1 minus lambda is equal to 0, or lambda is equal to negative 1. So when you have numbers that are along the diagonal and at least one zero, if it's a 2 by 2, if one of these is a zero, then you can immediately read off the eigenvalues for this. And if both of them are zero, then it's obvious. But if both of them are zero, then there's more to say about it if only one of them is zero. But I'm treating the case here where both of them are zero. Then your lambda is equal to one, negative one. And so what does A minus lambda I look like? So A minus lambda I, so negative 1 minus the negative 1 is 0.
So it's just a 2 by 2
zeros. It's just a 2 by 2 of zeros. All right? So your A minus lambda I is just a 0 matrix. And if you put V1 here and V2 there, and you want this to be equal 0, well, again, be careful. So I can write 0 is equal to 0 V1 plus 0 V2 is equal to 0. So 0 is equal to 0. So I have infinite choice. And so we can actually do both of your V's, and you're going to get different answers. So one of them is going to be 1, 0. Because if I let V1 be 0 and V2 be, I'm sorry, V1 is 1 and V2 is 0, well, that satisfies this equation. Agreed? And I can call this V1. And then V2, big V2, I can call that 0, 1. Because again, for the same reason, if little v1 is 0 and little v2 is 1, it satisfies this equation. But these are linearly independent vectors. In fact, you might recognize these as, like, this is I hat and this is J hat in a two-dimensional system. So, now that only happens when you have the zero matrix for your A minus lambda I. If you have any other number here, then you don't get this behavior. You have, if it's repeated eigenvalues, then you have to do something else. And so in this case, our solution is going to be X equals C1, 1, 0, e to the negative t plus p2, 0, 1, e to the negative t. And these are linearly independent solutions, so this is a perfectly good solution to your differential equation. But that happens because we had, not only did we have identical
eigenvalues, negative 1 and negative 1, but we ended up with a zero matrix here, and if it's not a zero matrix here, then we're going to, the situation becomes more complex, and that we're going to deal with next week. So the homework for next week is only going to be the two sections that we finished this week, so 3-3 and 3-4, and then 3-5, which shows up in the syllabus for this week. We'll finish that next week, and the homework for that will be due the week after. Does that make sense? Because I don't want you to have to struggle with, especially with, there's a formula that we have to derive, and it's a little bit complicated, so I want to make sure we have plenty of time to discuss it. Okay, so if you haven't turned in your homework, please do so. Otherwise, I will see you. Have a good weekend.